Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Greetings to our War Room podcast audience. I'm Jacqueline Witt, Professor of Strategy and the War Room podcast editor here at the U.S. Army War College. Thanks for joining us today. So I'm particularly excited about today's podcast. You see, most of the time here at War Room, I'm coordinating and recording podcasts on subjects and topics that are pretty far afield from my own expertise and research interest, and I learn a whole lot this way. But that's not actually the case today. Today we're going to discuss the influence and place of religion in the modern American military, looking at both the historical forces that have shaped that relationship and the consequences of that history for the contemporary military. My own first book was about military chaplains in the Vietnam War, and I've been thinking and writing about religion in the military and military chaplains for over a decade now. So I'm really thrilled to be recording a podcast with a fellow scholar and author in the field, and we're going to try really hard not to geek out too much. But I'm here today with Dr. Ronit Stahl, who is currently a fellow in advanced biomedical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. She is the author of the book Enlisting Faith: How the Military Chaplaincy Shaped Religion and the State in Modern America, which was published by Harvard University Press in 2017. So welcome to the War Room, Ronit.
Thank you for having me here today.
Great. So I want to start out actually with a place that I think a lot of conversations about military chaplains and religion sort of end up, which is the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, right? And this is we're really talking about one sentence of the whole thing, which says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." And so can you sort of walk us through how that one sentence has been interpreted in the context of the U.S. military?
Sure. One of the interesting things to me about this question is that as I was working on this project, depending on who I was talking to, this would be, as you mentioned, the question that would arise. Like, either in the sense of, wait, doesn't that violate the Constitution? Or, I just never thought about it that way before. And I think the military offers a really interesting space for consideration of the First Amendment. Now, it hasn't been litigated tremendously, and that for some may be surprising, given that it is a space of entanglement and interaction between religion and the state. For much of the 20th century, it was sort of an oblique part of legal references. So there was an early attempt at a lawsuit actually in the 1920s by the American Association for the Advancement of Atheism, which thought military chaplains violated the Constitution, but that was a lawsuit that never got off the ground. So it wasn't until the late 1970s and two Harvard Law students who started thinking about the military chaplaincy in their constitutional law class that we get this first lawsuit, Katkoff v. Marsh. And that was a lawsuit that their goal was to challenge the chaplaincy as a violation of the Establishment Clause. And the military realized that this, you know, was a lawsuit that could have legs. Right. There was a lot of concern.
I love this story in part because the Army gets sucked into it simply by responding to a FOIA request, right? And the Navy sort of escapes it by virtue of not doing what they were supposed to do.
Well, and actually just by charging money. Right. They said, like,
you need to pay us for photographs.
Exactly. Like, sure, we'll get you the documents, but pony and, up the cash.
Yeah, law students are like, yeah, forget that.
Right. And the Army, you know, was the bigger entity and, like, all of a sudden was like, whoa, this could be an issue. And it's interesting also, I'll get back to the case in a moment, but it's interesting because, you know, in the archives, it's not, I feel like the shadow of the First Amendment certainly hovers over the chaplaincy and certainly thinking about the chaplaincy. But in terms of day-to-day work, it was not something that the Army, you know, the chief of chaplains or anyone was like regularly.
Right. It's this like big structural issue on one hand and a pretty minor consideration, like you said, in the sort of day-to-day existence of military chaplains and of military personnel. So let's go back to this case because it's happening in a particular historical moment, right? Late 1970s. So post-Vietnam, probably right post one of the most divisive wars, and certainly a war in which religious communities have spoken out very, very strong, or some religious communities, right, have spoken out very strongly against the war. So what's the outcome? Where does this case sort of end up?
So it first goes before a trial judge where, you know, each side is trying to present the evidence of either why it is an Establishment Clause violation or why it isn't. And really the key issue for the law students is getting this lawsuit. They've graduated by the time it gets into a courtroom, but getting it off the ground. And the Army challenged it, trying to say, like, they don't have standing, there's no issue here, but the judge allowed it to go on. And there's the initial case, and it reaches eventually just the Second Circuit, where it ends up being pretty much pushed aside for reasons of standing, that these taxpayers don't really have the ability to pursue this case. But it wasn't just, you know, summarily dismissed. Rather, there is an opinion that says, well, you know, if we're starting to think about this, then we recognize that there is that the establishment question is a live one, that on, you know, the Lemon test, which was a test that came out of a 1973 case that said there needed not to be an excessive entanglement of religion, that legislation needed a secular purpose, that it couldn't prefer one religion or another. And, you know, they were like, well, this, you know, excessive entanglement, there is an issue, you know, potentially an issue here, but because military chaplains are serving soldiers who are often in sort of far-flung places that don't have access to religion the way they might in civilian life, we accept that this is something that is necessary, but they caution, like, maybe it wouldn't be necessary in U.S., you know, for right. bases in the U.S. And I think actually one of the most interesting outcomes of this case is not so much actually this question of establishment per se, but that one of the lawyers who had been a military chaplain, Israel Drazen, who the Army brings back to litigate this case, he starts to become aware, actually, his argument is there's no Establishment Clause violation. There's enough of a need that the military should be able to enable and to manage the chaplaincy to run it. But that there he had growing concerns about free exercise violations, that for this to work, for it not to be an Establishment Clause problem, the chaplaincy had to do what it could maximally to enable free exercise. And that then really sort of forces the military to start to think more broadly about what does that look like.
Right, and who has those protections? It was always interesting to me in thinking about sort of very late 20th century chaplains, what I saw as the turn from protecting free exercise rights of military service members to protecting the free exercise rights of chaplains. And that was a pretty significant shift in thinking, and I think one that we still see about who does the First Amendment protect and to what extent. So what do chaplains have to do? What are they allowed to not do? And so on and so forth.
And I think that is such an interesting question because there had been such wide consensus for so long that, you know, there are little issues maybe here or there about what a chaplain could or wouldn't do, but that really hadn't been the concern. And then suddenly it becomes the major concern as demographics both in the military and civilian society are shifting.
Sure. And yeah, it's demographics and social concerns and the politicization of religious communities in the U.S., like all of these are happening sort of at the same time to create this, again, in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, just this really interesting moment where you see all of this sort of come together. So if that's the end of the story in the 20th century, at least, and we can talk about where we are now in a little bit, we seem to have these couple of relationships, right? There's a relationship between chaplains and the state, and there's a relationship between religion and the state, and so all of these are in sort of triangulation with each other. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the, like, which way the influence is going, right? Is the relationship between church and state affecting the chaplaincy? Is the chaplaincy affecting the macro level relationship between church and state in the U.S.? How is that influence happening?
So I think the influence is always bidirectional. Now, the weight of the influence may be more in one direction or less in a, you know, there may be some degree of exchange. But what I mean by that is The chaplaincy is both setting up a structure in which what counts as American religion, what religions are accommodated, what practices are available, are present for military personnel. And that in turn creates a space for religious groups to lobby, right? They either initially for inclusion in some cases, for accommodation, for an ability to participate in this space. And so there is this back and forth and a willingness on the part of some groups to compromise or not. So, you know, one group that I think is really interesting over the course of the 20th century is Seventh-day Adventists, in part because initially they're really skeptical of the chaplaincy actually as a constitutional problem and potentially as a problem for them as a religious group, that this would get them too kind of close to the government, that and there might be restrictions on them. And they know that because they observe a Saturday Sabbath, they run into certain obstacles. But over time, as you get more Seventh-day Adventists serving as chaplains, you also then start to see how they're able to work with the military to start to recognize these spaces as and what sort of the needs are, but also a certain degree of flexibility, right? That they are trying, one of the things they recognize is when you have Seventh-day Adventist chaplains, you have the ability to intervene. So when soldiers had been court-martialed for refusing to obey direct orders, usually around guard duty on the Sabbath or sort of things that didn't necessarily look religious, but were for them religious, the ability to have a chaplain in that space to say, wait a second, this is religious, but maybe we can also figure out.
He's not just shamming, right?
This is legit.
This is a real thing.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, and I think we see that story, right, with Seventh-day Adventists, with Church of Latter-day Saints chaplains, with Mormon chaplains, with Greek Orthodox chaplains, like all of these places where sort of minority religious viewpoints start to come in and they become normalized within this macro level structure because the chaplaincy is big and the U.S. military is huge and it can erase difference really, really quickly in some cases. So everybody gets lumped together into this like general Protestant category or this very broad other category. And so you see that happening over time, but it's not always an easy mix, right? Where do you think are the biggest, or where did you see the sort of biggest seams for this relationship?
Right, so there is a lot of friction and tension, and I think where that lies really depends on the scale we're looking at. So, you know, at a micro level, there are certainly plenty of incidents along the way, right? A soldier not allowed to, say, practice, you know, worship or Sabbath observance or access their dietary needs and specifically the way they want. So there's some negotiation over that. But I think the bigger picture is really between religious groups and the chaplaincy itself and the ways in which they're trying often to say, well, wait a second here. You understand, you know, religion in one particular way, say a Sunday morning, 1 hour worship service is like what you need. Like we're good to go as long as we have that. And many religious groups saying, actually, our needs are different than that. So we need to find a way, whether it's access to the chapel at other times or other types of services, or in the case of food. I mean, food is a big issue because, right, it's a mainstay of daily life. So Jews and Muslims, for example, wanting to access kosher halal food, Seventh-day Adventists, vegetarian food. And actually, one of my favorite stories from the archives is a Catholic chaplain during World War II, who desperately wanted the military to serve fish on Fridays as a way to ease the ability of Catholic soldiers to observe the laws of abstinence. And what he said, what I thought was so telling, though, about the claims he made. So he was making this claim specifically for Catholics. Like, wouldn't it be better if it was just easy for Catholics
to do what they need to do?
But then he says, and actually, fish are kosher, so Jews will eat fish, and Protestants like fish too. Like, he was like,
it's also not a big deal, right?
Right. So trying, and now the military was not actually really interested in this argument, and it really never went anywhere. Yeah. But I thought it was telling both that he, the way to make a claim for a specific religious group was actually to say that more broadly it was functional, mm-hmm. right? That it wasn't just for one particular group, but that everyone could enjoy the fruits right. of this particular request. And so that's an area where, you know, again, over the 20th century, there's going to be a lot of back and forth over food. It's really not until you get to an era of MREs that you can really maximize the variety.
The variety and making sure certain people are getting certain meals. Yeah, it's certainly not not in the era of sea rations. Not quite so.
Not quite so simple.
I'd like to ask you what was the most surprising or the most sort of unexpected thing that you found while you were doing research and writing?
I think there were a couple things. One was just a fun find that I had read in there's a journal that goes through a number of different names, the Army Chaplain, the Army and Navy Chaplain. And I'd read about this radio show, Chaplain Jim, mm-hmm. which is a World War II era radio show. And I kept wondering, well, what was this show about? I'd been like looking to see if I could find any, any recordings, which I didn't find. But what I did find was the whole run of transcripts in the National Archives that had the chief of chaplain's red pencil marks on them and how he edited them.
So this is going to be the greatest loss when we go to digital records. Right. We're going to lose all of the editing.
It's amazing, right? Yeah. It's amazing to see these changes and his real efforts to promote a very specific public ecumenical chaplain to the home front during World War II. And getting to see how he did that in cooperation with this private group. But so that was just kind of a fun find. One of the things that was really striking to me, and I'm curious if you noticed this in your research on Vietnam, was that, you know, in World War II, end of tour reports were frankly kind of boring. Like they were like, all right, like, you know, I did like this many worship services, this many baptisms. It was just very quantitative. And there was a lot of great material in letters and journals, but the end of tour reports themselves were not amazing, except for sort of this demographic and quantitative work. But Vietnam, I found, at least for the Navy chaplains who served with the Marines in Vietnam, produced these often like 10 to 15 page essays mm-hmm. on their experiences. And I hadn't expected to find them, right? I didn't know that those would exist.
Right.
And it was really, what was so striking to me was they were really pausing to reflect in very honest ways about their experiences. Like, these were no holds barred. Like, they had real concerns. They both were proud of their service and also really concerned about what was happening. And they put it out there for people, you know, internally at the time, of course, but still, like, they were not quiet, you know, in the ways that we might expect yeah. them to have been.
No, I found the same thing. Now, the Army, I mean, they keep the numbers and, like, all of the tallies of worship services and offerings, sort of, all of that's there, and you can do all of that. No, but I thought the same thing, and I think part of it, right, is they're rotating, they're cycling through quite quickly. They're a little bit older, right, than the sort of average enlisted person. So you start to see this really wrestling with the question of meaning in that war, and some change over time, right? Because American chaplains are there for over a decade, and so I think you can really see a difference between the chaplains who are there in you know 65 and the ones who are there in 72. Like that's a pretty big
really difference.
Difference in terms of what they're dealing with and how they're understanding their work with soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines, but also the way they write about it afterwards, I think is fascinating. I'm sure you do too. I have a whole little collection, right, of like these very strange chaplain memoirs.
Yes.
That come out and people sent me, in the mail in all sorts of ways that I've gotten my hands on them. If we move away from the 20th century and start thinking about the 21st, and it's still stunning to me that we're like 18 years and it still feels new to me. But what do we see as the sort of consequences of this historical relationship between the church and state and chaplaincy? What are the implications of that? Where do we think we're headed in the 21st century?
Right. So I think some of the issues that were bubbling under the surface have really come out. And some of those are issues that are dealt with kind of on a policy or legislative level that I think it's important to recognize the historical antecedent. So I'm thinking here of really the recent policy changes on, for example, the permission to wear beards and head coverings. And that was actually an issue in the 1950s. And mm-hmm. so it took a really long time to settle, but it was there for a long time. And I think with a more diverse America writ large and the recognition of the changing look of the U.S. military, it was important to find way to really finally have concrete policy that addressed those issues. But I think the two big areas that will continue to kind of fester and challenge the chaplaincy and civilian society is the pressure from two flanks about what religion is and what religious mm-hmm. freedom looks like and what free exercise of religion looks like. As you said earlier, this question of what chaplains can do or can refuse to do is one dimension of it, but really just who the chaplains are. And on the one hand, the increase in religious diversity, the inclusion of Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and the very live question right now about a humanist chaplain. And then on the other side, evangelical and fundamentalist and other conservative Protestant groups and chaplains who feel like they've become marginalized within this space, mm-hmm. even though actually percentage-wise, they're a tremendous right. part of the chaplain corps. But this conflict between what does American religion look like, I think, is an ongoing one. I don't know that it'll ever be resolved, but I think the military is a flashpoint because it's sort of this contained space in which it has to get worked out, at least momentarily, in one way right. or another. And you can't just shove people aside and say, nope, too bad.
And you can fix certain things, like you said, by policy and by guidance and legislation, but there are also deeper cultural things that have to be worked out. There are interpersonal things that have to be worked out, right? Who counts, like, at a fundamental level? This question of humanist chaplains, I think, is just one of the most interesting ones out there. Because, yeah, you've got questions about what is religion? What does that mean? What does it mean for a chaplain to serve in a force that is increasingly atheist, agnostic, or right, the nuns? I'm using air quotes. You can't see that on the podcast, right? But people who say I'm spiritual but not religious, I'm not anything in particular. What is a chaplain there for?
Right. And I think it really raises this question. You know, in the early part of the 20th century, there was a big push in terms of professionalizing the chaplaincy to move away from auxiliary duties, right. which might have been like working the library or the post office, these other things.
Whatever
was needed, call the chaplain. The chaplain will take care of it.
Because the chaplain's educated, the chaplain is literate, right?
There's right. all sorts could of, take care of things that other people things. Couldn't. But one of the consequences of this professionalization, and so if the chaplain is then supposed to be really focused on religion and welfare, well, this raises this question certainly in this moment of, right, again, for people who are spiritual in some way, whatever that way is, or seek guidance and counseling of some sort, but not necessarily in a traditional form. From talking to a number of people these days, one of the big questions, because of, you know, increasing attention to mental health and kind of this holistic sense of welfare, you know, people do have needs, and some of them don't want to see psychologists or psychiatrists for a variety of reasons, some good, some bad. Some, you know, want counseling and guidance, and the chaplain can do that. And I think, you know, part of the, you know, there's a recent conversations about the humanist chaplain. And one of the things I do find frustrating about some of the conversations publicly is a not necessarily full recognition of what chaplains do and how they mm-hmm. function within this space. So, I mean, and one just fundamental feature of the chaplaincy is that chaplains have to serve everyone. So it doesn't matter whether you're a Muslim imam, a Jewish rabbi, a Catholic priest, a fundamentalist pastor, your responsibility is still for everyone. And so when you start to think about then what would a humanist chaplain look like, I think it has to be within that framework, not simply, well, my church or my synagogue or my mosque would never hire you know, a humanist, so it doesn't make sense.
That would be a different sort of thing.
It's a different role. Yeah. And we have to like recognize that the chaplain's role is a specific and particular role that has some overlap with civilian religion spaces and also some really important distinctions.
Right.
And so if you're task is to serve everyone. What does that look like? Who can do it? Chaplains have always been responsible for facilitating any number of religious activities that they themselves may not be able to lead or even participate in, but that is their role. So how do we handle that? And I think the other space that the chaplaincy has been really interesting to watch in this moment is how it is producing a reckoning, or it's a cauldron of change for religious groups really grappling with gender politics and the ways in which women may or may not have leadership roles within various religious spaces. Because mm-hmm. this is a space where, you know, because of the Constitution, the military does defer to religious groups in terms of what counts as a religious leader.
Right.
Like, that is up to religious groups to decide. The state is not making a decision right. there. Well, and this has come up in the case of nuns, in this case Catholic nuns, in the case of Muslim women who seek leadership roles, in the case of Southern Baptist ministers, and who has authority in these spaces. It matters for then who can be mm-hmm. a chaplain and who is seen as a religious leader.
Yeah, and you have two institutions, right, a military and often religious organizations that are full of gendered sort of politics and dynamics, but in different ways, and they're grappling with them in different contexts as well.
And one of the things that's been really interesting to me in talking to a number of different women who are current military chaplains is that the ways in which they, you know, the affinity with other chaplains is really important to them. And sometimes they've said, you know, it's actually other chaplains, they may run into issues with members of their own church even, but other chaplains like have their back mm-hmm. and that really matters to them. So it, you know, it's important for the internal dynamic within the chaplaincy. It's important for the interface between chaplains, soldiers, sailors, other personnel, and also again, between the military and these religious right. groups.
No, I want to end with a brief question. As our listeners sort of read the news or they come across stories where, say, free exercise or religious freedom or religious practices are sort of mentioned in a military context, right? Whether this is wearing head coverings or beards or like national days of prayer, whatever it is, what are the things that you would like for them to keep in mind as they're consuming news about religion and the military and the way they go together?
Oh, what a great question. A few things. First, I think it's really important to recognize that the military is a specific space, and it's a space in which people live together, eat together, fight together, work together. And so what the norms are, or what the norms need to be, may well be different from what someone might expect at, you know, in their home community, whether that's their church community, their school community, their workspace. And so just keeping in mind that it is different.
It's an exceptional space.
Right. And so within that, and that then raises the second question of there's never like sort of full, pure religious freedom, a sort of everyone can do what they want all the time, anytime, in any place. There's always limits. So the question isn't, are there limits or should there be limits, but rather, where's the limit? Where's the boundary? Where are the lines being drawn? And one of the questions that then becomes really important to the military, because it is such a diverse institution and because personnel are not just in the U.S., but abroad, is what does respect look like in that space? Respect for oneself and one's religion, respect for others and other religions, respect for global religious communities. And so there may be, those lines may in fact shift not only within the military, but within whatever the specific military space someone is in, because it's different when you're, you know, if you're on a submarine, that's a really different type of right. space than everyone, you know, going to work from 9 to 5 and going home.
Fort Hood or Carlisle Barracks.
Exactly. And so there may need to be, you know, a different sensibility. And part of what I noticed, and I think is so interesting, just tracking the chaplaincy over the 20th century, is in fact the ways in which bringing people together does tend to force a type of rethinking and thinking about this space in very thoughtful ways, right? That even people who came in with an assumption of I should be allowed to do anything or someone else shouldn't be allowed to do some practice often do shift because they actually recognize people, as complex, as needing different things. So to always keep in mind that when you're not in the middle of it, and this is true, of course, in civilian life, but again, I think particularly acute in the military space, that, you know, respecting that when people say that they feel challenged in one way or another, you have to stop and listen. And maybe it's something that can be accommodated. Maybe it's something that can't be. But don't, you know, I think there's often an assumption that if like I say that I'm respecting you, that like that holds. And the question is, do you think I'm respecting you? And again, because of the particular space, that has to be worked out. And so finally, that to think about the ways in which the military in some ways, there's an accelerated decision-making process. Now, of course, as I said, these things can take a really long time, right? This issue of beards was present in the 1950s. But at the same time, change can happen quickly because a policy shift happens and suddenly there's a new policy that everyone is going to follow. It is a hierarchical organization.
Right, so and smartly and...
And so, right.
And move out, right?
And so, you know, so what's really important is actually, I think, how that those decisions then are thoughtfully made. And, you know, there is, you know, in addition to the sort of triangle we talked about earlier between the state and God and soldiers, there's also a triangle between the military, Congress, legislators, the military, Congress, and the courts. And, you know, who's saying who gets to... Make decisions, checks and balances
are still real.
Are real, and thinking about who has the capacity to, accumulate the information, but then also assess it thoughtfully is really important.
No, I think this has left us with lots of things to think about. I think the idea that there's always space for sort of negotiation and communication, and there's lots of give and take in all of this, and lots of specific questions that have to be asked in addition to the very general ones. And I think those are good guidelines as we look at news stories, as we look at news coverage, or even think through specific questions in our own posts or commands or things like that. So I'd like to thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining me today, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to really dig into a topic that I think is both interesting and deeply important. So this is Jackie Witt. I'm signing off for War Room.
This is Ronit Stahl. Thank you so much.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.